welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about James Forsyth's cover piece, in which he suggests that Theresa May has been dealt a pack of aces for her Brexit negotiations. We'll also be looking at Sadiq Khan's progress as mayor, half a year into his tenure, and we'll be looking at whether Advent's actually better than Christmas. The morning after Brexit, Britain looked like it might be in crisis. The Prime Minister had resigned, Scotland was suggesting a second referendum, and the FTSE was in freefall. Britain looked like it may be the next Greece, facing a terrible EU deal. But, as James says in this week's cover story, the Prime Minister is now going into the negotiations with a pack of aces. He joins me now, along with Isabel Hardman, our assistant editor. So James, in this week's cover, we've got Corbyn, Trump and a crumbling euro depicted as these aces. Why are these good cards for May?
So I mean, there are five things that mean that Britain's negotiating position is stronger than it looked like being on the morning of June the 24th. The first is, as you said, the economy has simply not collapsed. Britain is not going to go into this negotiation desperate for a deal, any deal. The second is Scotland. I think there was, you know, even one of the people who represented the Leave side in the TV debate said to me that they felt sick to their stomach when they saw Nicola Sturgeon talking about a second independence referendum the morning afterwards. There was a real fear that the vote to leave might have given the SNP the grounds for a divorce that they've been so desperately looking for. But there has actually been no upsurge in support for independence. It is still below 50%. And I think the SNP have also chosen the wrong hill on which to fight. They keep talking about single market access. Then considering 64% of Scottish goods go to the UK single market, and I think only 17% to the EU one, it's clear which of those is economically more important. But then the third thing is President Trump. I think he has changed the dynamics of the Brexit negotiation because he's made the UK's offer on security far more important to Europe than it was before. You know, I think you can now say that, Britain is more important to Europe's security than it has been for 60 years. And with Vladimir Putin clearly intending to probe for signs of irresolution and weakness, you know, just look at the movement of these nuclear-capable missiles to Russia's western enclave in Kaliningrad. Britain's role here is very important, and I think it is impossible to see how you could punish Britain for Brexit and then still expect Britain to offer those security guarantees. I mean, the other way in which Trump changes things is his keenness for a trade deal with the UK. You know, I think that those around him, those advisors, say, look, we're not against trade per se. We're against trade deals with low-wage economies. The UK isn't that. And I think they view a trade deal with the UK as a way of saying, look, we're only against those kind of trade deals. And then I think the fifth thing is the euro. The Italian referendum on December the 4th, I think, could trigger the Eurozone crisis moving from its current kind of chronic phase back into an acute one. It could involve early elections in Italy next year that put the very future of Italian membership of the Euro on the table. And the reason why that is a trump card for Theresa May is that London is the de facto financial and banking capital of the Eurozone. The more vulnerable the single currency looks, the more of a risk it is for EU leaders to kind of erect barriers between the Eurozone and its financial and banking capital. Now, people often say that politics will trump economics in this negotiation. I think that might well be right. But remember that the euro is a fundamentally political project. And I find it hard to believe that Eurozone governments and the EU are going to be prepared risking making the single currency kind of collateral damage in these discussions.
And Isabel, what do you make of James's argument that the Prime Minister has a pack of aces?
Well, I think she's definitely got a pack of aces in Parliament because Labour is so weak. As James says, she has a commanding 28-point lead over Jeremy Corbyn on the question of who would make the better Prime Minister. And Labour's particularly weak on the question of Europe because of Jeremy Corbyn's own ambivalence on the issue. He often uses statements in the Commons not to scrutinise the Prime Minister on her negotiating position or prowess, but actually to have a moan about the things about Europe that he doesn't like. He isn't able to scrutinise the deal that the Prime Minister is aiming for, but neither are his MPs. They have been trying, the backbenchers, to organise a better scrutiny operation themselves, and they wrote a letter this week warning about the risks of a hard Brexit for their own communities that they represent. But even those MPs are really compromised because most of those communities voted for out. So there's no strong voice in the Commons, and this is really something that those who don't want a hard Brexit or those who are generally worried about how good a deal Theresa May could still get should be worried about, because a lack of parliamentary scrutiny may make life easier for Theresa May and gives her a pack of aces in terms of going into the Commons and thinking, well, this is going to be all right. I'm going to have half an hour answering pretty poor questions. But it doesn't necessarily make for a better deal. As James says, that things look good on the European front for Britain, particularly now that Europe needs to rely more on Britain for security. But there's not the pressure from Parliament to come back and spell out exactly what the deal is that benefits Britain.
And obviously, we're talking about everything going on prior to Article 50 being triggered. Do you think things could change, and do you think her cards could get weaker in the next few months?
Look, of course, because I think one of the things is that this negotiation, it's going to be a classic EU negotiation. Everything will be done at the very last minute. So really the kind of question is, what do her cards look like in January, February of 2019 rather than now? I think also you could say that, look, the EU27 are being remarkably united at the moment. You know, they clearly do not want to suggest that you can leave the EU and still have all the benefits of membership without having any of the so-called costs. But I think the point is this, in a way, is the Eurozone crisis and the Trump thing, I think those are now kind of permanent features of the system. And that does strengthen her hand. I think the other thing is, the question is, does the UK economy remain as resilient as it has been in the last few months? Or does, you know, uncertainty begin to kick in? I think one of the things that she needs to do to combat that is to make clear that if Britain can't get a deal with the EU, it's not going to be passive. It's going to take dramatic, radical steps to improve its competitiveness globally, you know, slashing corporation tax, getting rid of a cap on bankers' bonuses, all that kind of thing that would make the UK more competitive, to show that, you know, that it's not going to be a simple case of, oh, we haven't got a deal, we've fallen off a cliff edge and we're not doing anything about it.
And in James's piece as well, he suggests that it's a diplomatic minefield that Britain faces. Do you think there's the necessary skill available to navigate through this?
Well, there have been lots of warnings over the last few weeks that Whitehall isn't equipped to deal with Brexit, that we don't have the skills diplomatically to do this. But it's always the case that whenever a government embarks on any major project, there are people who are saying, we don't have enough of this. You'll never, just as we've got the autumn statement this week, you'll never get a press release after the autumn statement from any charity saying, charity thrilled and thinks autumn statement is exactly what it asked for. It's always not enough, basically. So we don't really know how skilled and how capable Whitehall is until it starts doing it, basically.
I think one of the things is that Britain has always regarded the EU as a kind of transactional thing, you know, it's a simple cost-benefit analysis, and when the costs outweigh the benefits, you leave, as I think happened on June the 23rd. For Europeans, this is an emotional project. You know, kind of Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, you know, says that he physically cried when he heard that Britain had voted to leave. And so I think we need to do things that demonstrate that we intend to be good neighbours, and that also to show they feel kind of increasingly encircled and that their whole project is in danger of collapse. What we need to do is to show as a country that we're not trying to precipitate that collapse, and that, you know, we intend to kind of stay close to them, both in terms of security and kind of culturally. I think one thing we could do is start talking about a kind of Rhodes Scholars style scheme for people from the EU, all that kind of thing, to show we're going to be good neighbours after Brexit.
And in your piece, you also mentioned European domestic politics. We've obviously got the German elections and the French elections, and Merkel said she's standing again. What would be the best outcome for Britain from those?
I actually think the thing that could have the most dramatic effect on the Brexit negotiations is this Italian referendum, if Renzi loses it and it leads to elections in Italy early next year, because I think that would put huge stress on the whole Eurozone project. I think in terms of the French elections, the best result for Britain actually, I think, would be for Marine Le Pen to be thoroughly thrashed in the second round, because I think the more that the Europeans feel that they're not combating some populist wave that is about to engulf them, the more prepared they will be to kind of move away from this idea of kind of punishing Britain for Brexit. I think Angela Merkel is almost certain to win again in Germany. I think that the real question about Germany is what the composition of her coalition is. I'd also say watch the Dutch elections. It could be quite interesting. I don't think he'll be able to form a government, but if Geert Wilders' party comes top, that'll be another sign of how in one of the founding states of the EU, there is such profound disenchantment with the project.
And just finally, obviously we're talking about this metaphor of a game of cards. If Theresa May's cards are so obvious, is it going to be hard for her to bluff in the negotiations?
I think one of the things about Theresa May, which her domestic colleagues, cabinet colleagues even, would say, is that she does play her cards incredibly close to her chest. I think that if you go to any of the kind of EU embassies in London, it turns out that their discussions, their prime minister's discussions, or their head of government's discussion with Theresa May, has not left them any the wiser as to what she wants, and that she does stick literally in private to what she says in public about seeking the best possible deal, etc., etc., etc.
There is definitely a great curiosity from those working in embassies to find out what Theresa May is thinking, to the extent that they ask journalists, and journalists don't know either, because Number 10 has become much more of a closed operation since she came in. I think that the bigger risk actually is that European leaders will provide a running commentary on the negotiations in a way that she will find unhelpful.
And James, Philip Hammond has presented the autumn statement. What kind of tone did that strike?
Philip Hammond was, I think, more bullish about the economy and Brexit than he normally is. He announced that, yes, the OBR had downgraded the growth forecast, but he kind of relished in a rather un-Hammond way, pointing out that Britain would still be growing faster than France and Italy, despite these downgraded growth forecasts for next year. I think there is a question about what effect uncertainty has on the UK economy in the run-up to these talks, which are, you know, in that classic European way, are going to take place right at the very last minute in 2019. But I think you saw from Philip Hammond in the autumn statement a kind of deliberate attempt to avoid being tagged as someone who is kind of moaning about the results of the referendum. Although, you know, the numbers in terms of extra borrowing that the OBR suggests is happening, in inverted commas, because of Brexit, you know, are obviously sizeable.
Yeah, I thought he was much less gloomy than I expected him to be, and that lots of cabinet ministers have been criticising Hammond for being too gloomy in his assessments of the effects of Brexit on the British economy. And he clearly decided to be a little bit more, not upbeat, but just a little bit perhaps more sober in his judgments.
That was James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. So London's new mayor, Sadiq Khan, is riding high in the polls. But as Andrew Gilligan says in this week's issue of The Spectator, City Hall insiders are less than impressed with him. I'm now joined by Andrew and Richard Watts, a Labour councillor, to discuss. So Andrew, he's 5 months into the job. Has he impressed you?
Well, he's had a pretty good start. I mean, the first 6 months of Boris's term were kind of strewn with the corpses of discarded deputy mayors. Sadiq's had a much smoother start. He's... You know, the predictions of catastrophe made by Zach Goldsmith, his opponent, simply haven't happened. And he's obviously looked extremely good by comparison with most other politicians, because it's been an exceptionally bad 6 months for the political class generally. He's looked like the only grown-up in the room over Brexit. His PR and positioning has been brilliant. My long-term concern and my medium concern about him is that there's not much substance there yet. A lot of press releases, a lot of announcements, a certain amount of slagging off his predecessor, which is inevitable, I suppose, and I declare an interest because I worked with his predecessor. But on actual policy changes, on actual substance of things that, you know, might have powers he can actually exercise, we haven't seen very much, and people are starting to notice inside the machine, if not outside. And they're also finding him, and these are people on his own side, principally, they're finding him a rather abrasive personality that they don't particularly take to.
Richard, do you think that's fair, that it's more style over substance?
I don't actually know. I agree with Andrew that the political positioning that Sadiq's had in his first few months has been spot on, and he's handled some incredibly difficult situations. And given what was said about him during a really unpleasant mayoral election campaign, actually I think he's done a really good job in holding our city together through incredibly turbulent times. And that's actually one of the first jobs of the mayor and shouldn't be underestimated. Where I disagree with Andrew is about the long-term job that Sadiq is doing. You know, actually, most of the day-to-day governance of London is done by the 33 borough councils, not the mayor. It's a strategic job, not a day-to-day one. And if I think the work that Sadiq is doing on strategic change around housing and around transport all will bear fruit within his first 4 years. What they're not going to do is see many results for the first few months, first year or so. You know, we need to get to 50,000 housing starts a year in London. There aren't the bricks to do that, let alone the people to build the houses, let alone the sites, let alone the people to connect those houses to the national grid. You know, there's a big job to do to get us to the level of house building we need, and that was never going to be done in a few months.
He's watered down quite a lot of his election promises already, is another of my concerns. I mean, I think the key promise was that Londoners wouldn't pay a penny more in their fares. Well, obviously, when the fares increase comes round in January, I think quite a lot of Londoners, in fact, probably the majority of people who use the Underground, will find that they are paying quite a lot more pennies for their fares, because travel cards, Oyster price caps are going up. And that wasn't what he promised in the election. And that's the first really serious broken promise. But there's a whole load of other smaller ones which it doesn't look like he's going to keep. I mean, my own area, cycling, he promised to accelerate the cycling programme, deliver more routes. He actually been cancelling routes in the last week or so, and certainly everything on cycling has dramatically slowed down there. There's been no replacement for me, my old job of cycling commissioner, more than 6 months after it was made vacant. And there's been, you know, some shallow appointments like the nightclub, the night czar, Amy LeMay, who happens to be a donor of his and fundraiser for him. And she clearly was an unsuitable appointment. And that's sort of potentially symptomatic of the kind of shallowness of the mayoralty that is a potential risk to it.
I think I'm going to disagree with a bunch of what Andrew said there, actually. I think we are seeing progress on stuff like cycle routes. What we're not doing is what happened, actually, something done under Andrew's time as commissioner, where we saw cycle routes trying to be imposed on local areas and they're not working. I think we're not going to get the kind of really significant shift in the kind of transport that we want in London unless we bring local people with you. And I think that's the investment in time and in hearts and minds that we need to do if we're going to get the kind of big shifts in cycling that we need. On Amy LeMay's appointment, I don't think what Andrew said is right, actually. I think there is by far the most transparent appointment process we've seen of any of this kind of significant mayoral appointments.
She was a donor. She was approached to apply for the job. The whole open appointment process was a pretense.
But it was an open appointment process, and she got the job. She's clearly a very good candidate, actually.
She knows a lot about it. She can't even face the London Assembly. They can't even put her up to the London Assembly to answer questions because they're worried about how she performed.
Well, I think she made some pretty unwise tweets, and I don't like some of the language that she used about that. I don't think that's very in keeping with the tone of Sadiq's mayoralty. However, I do think actually she's done a pretty good job in getting through some pretty tricky issues, well, like Fabric Nightclub in my own borough.
That's not her doing, is it? I mean, that was a deal between your council and the club, and indeed the council statement about it made no mention of her. I mean, Lam is an interesting example. She's being paid her official City Hall salary through a tax-avoiding personal service company. That is just wrong. I mean, this is a woman who spent most of her life virtue signalling on Twitter about the need for higher public spending and the wicked evil Tories making all these cuts, while herself not being prepared to contribute her share to the public spending, which pays her salary.
Well, I think on Amy's tax details, I don't know very much about those. It's a thing that we've stopped in Islington Council. I would hope that the Stig does exactly the same.
But that's a symptom, isn't it? They must have seen how that would play because they must know this is an issue. It did Ken a huge amount of damage, and even he was on the payroll when he was at City Hall.
But as you say yourself, actually, what we've seen is a really sure step in the vast majority of the appointments Sadiq has made. I think Boris was down 6 deputy mayors at this point in his tenure, and Sadiq's appointments have so far proved remarkably solid and well respected and doing a really good job. Well, so I think in the main Sadiq has got his appointments absolutely right. I think Amy will turn out to be a good appointment too.
I want to go back to
Sadiq's the first mayor to have appointed a night czar. It's a funny old job title, but actually the nighttime economy is incredibly critical to our
decent to do the
and
job.
I think what Amy has got is incredibly good connections across the industry, and she's a classic lovey hypocrite. But it's a pretty lovey business, isn't it?
The nighttime economy is really important.
The
nighttime economy is police and public service workers, transport, takeaways. It's all sorts of things other than nightclubs. And even if it were nightclubs, all sorts of people who are a lot better qualified than her. But let me take you back to something you said before. I think what you're saying about the need to kind of build consensus in communities. My concern is, in lots of ways, he reminds me of New Labour. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. They won lots of elections. He praised Blair in his first newspaper interview. But actually, one of the things that Blair came to regret in the end was trying to triangulate, trying to kind of have a middle way, trying to keep everyone happy. And he, in the end, found that left no one happy. You came up with unsatisfactory compromises that nobody liked. And I think that's the trouble. I think he thinks there's some kind of magic formula that you can come up with to, for instance, get cycle routes through and everyone loves them. There isn't. You have to make a choice here. You have to make a choice between people who want to drive their cars without let or hindrance and people who believe that the car is overprovided for.
And in Andrew's piece, he actually suggests that Sadiq Khan's already looking forward to the next job, perhaps as the kind of next Labour leader. Do you think that's fair comment?
No, actually. I genuinely don't think that's the conversations I've had with Sadiq, that's where he's thinking at all. I think, you know, clearly he's an ambitious politician, but he knows that whatever future success he has depends on doing this job well. And I think, as far as Andrew's criticism of trying to keep everyone happy goes, well, I think we're going to see on some really big issues as we start to see the housing strategy develop or the air pollution strategy develop. You're right, it's impossible to do that. But what we need to do in all of those issues is to strike deals between borough councils, planning departments, between development companies, and so actually having somebody who can talk to...
get started on that. But the trouble is, on the difficult stuff, I've seen no sign of any actual stuff getting started.
I think he's never going to be stronger than now.
This is his time of maximum strength. This is where he should be absolutely coming off the box racing. And all we've seen is quite a lot of press releases.
And I think on the really big stuff, you know, housing, transport, air quality, actually a lot of work is going on behind the scenes at the moment. And over the next couple of weeks, we are going to see some major announcements that couldn't have taken taken place unless people have got all the big players in the room and started to do the deals between them, which is very much what the mayor should do.
I really hope so, but you know, we haven't seen much yet, and it is nearly 7 months now.
And just finally, in your piece, Andrew, you mentioned the Capital City Foundation, which is going to be keeping an eye on Sadiq. What would you be looking for that would impress you?
Well, I want to see actual kind of decisiveness on policy. I want to see real substance rather than press releases and shallow announcements like I'm going to send a bill to Volkswagen for £2.5 million for not paying a congestion charge. You know, that gets you a headline, but it doesn't advance the cause of clean air in London one jot. I want to see actual work on advancing the cause of clean air in London, like, for instance, building cycle routes. I also think he should beware of starting to believe his own press, quite sensitive about criticism. He hasn't been criticised much. It's going to happen more and more, and that's what happens. And I think he needs to be able to respond well to criticism and where it's merited. We're going to be constructively critical. I actually think he's a pretty good thing in lots of ways, like I said at the beginning. But I think he's got to avoid falling for his own press.
That was Andrew Gilligan and Richard Watts. And finally, as Christmas celebrations creep up earlier, Yacinda Maxtone Graham suggests in this week's Spectator that we must preserve the distinctive spirit of the season of Advent. I'm now joined by Yacinda to discuss. So Yacinda, why is it that you like Advent so much?
Well, I make a very strict rule that I never ever listen to any Christmas or Advent music until Advent Sunday, which this year I say is mercifully early on the 27th of November. I love it because it has got a bit more subtle, dark, mysterious beauty than Christmas, because it is both a season when we wait for the coming of Christ and the season when we wait for the birth of Christ. So there's this second coming, slightly judgmental aspect to it, which I find very...
So it's a slightly more reflective period than the actual period of Christmas.
Yes, exactly.
And you mentioned in your piece you like the mix of bitterness and sweetness. Is that just in the music, or is it in sort of a broader
I think
way?
Perhaps in the liturgy as well. I think perhaps the liturgy... Yes, I say in the piece that the French nickname for Lent is Le Petit Carême, the Little Lent. And I think that the vestments go slightly purple during Advent, that slightly atoning sort of colour. Mm. And it's a time to, of bitter as well as sweet things.
And actually, we had Melanie McDonough on the podcast a few weeks ago talking, mm-hmm. and she was talking about Halloween and not celebrating it too early. And she was also talking about how we now celebrate Christmas almost the wrong way around. So not traditionally you would have celebrated after Christmas, but now we go into this period of kind of purging ourselves. Do you think that's
Yes, that
that's
does
wrong?
Seem to be the case. I spoke to the Dean of Westminster just down the road this week, who said exactly that Christmas used to... I mean, the choristers used to say in the Abbey till the 28th of December. Now they all go home at tea time on Christmas Day. It's over pretty well. And it's going backwards now, right deep into
so
December.
The period beforehand is a slightly more reflective.
Exactly. So that's why we need to maybe wait till the mid-teens of December till we allow ourselves to sing the real Christmas carols. And in the early part, we must stick to O Come, Emmanuel.
And in your piece, you've spoken to a few clergy. Which one do they prefer?
Well, I think they prefer Advent in some ways, because it's... One said to me, it's countercultural. It's the opposite of what's going on in Marks and Spencers, because it's a time of quietness. I mean, when I talked to Bruce Ruddock, one of the canons at Peterborough, the service opens in darkness, and one candle is lit, and the light gradually spreads out, and it's a time of reflection, darkness, and far removed from what's going on in the tinselly world.
Yeah, and do you think people have a similar attitude towards Lent as well, that they actually prefer Lent to Easter?
It's perhaps they do, although you don't have to give things up in Advent, I don't think, which is a relief.
Yeah. And do you think the music is better for Advent rather
than
Christmas?
Yes, I mean, I love them both. I really do, and I wouldn't ever slag off Lovely Once in Royal. But there's more variety perhaps in Advent, because you can pick from a wider variety of subjects. For example, the Lamentations of Jeremiah, or predictions from Isaiah, or Psalms which aren't all too jolly. So I do think there's more inspiration perhaps for composers with Advent pieces.
And finally, this Sunday, what will be the first carol that you will be listening to?
Well, I'm going to go to the New College Oxford service at 5:30. I'm very excited. But also on the way to that, I'll be listening to St John's College Cambridge on Radio 3 at 3 o'clock till 4:30. So my day's cut out for me, and it'll be O Come Emmanuel will be the one I look forward to.
That was Yacinda Maxtone Graham. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes Store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including our Holy Smoke podcast, where this week Damien Thompson sat down with Quentin Letts and Harry Mount to discuss Brexit and the clergy. And if you enjoy our podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed today, as well as great pieces by Cosme Landesman, Melanie Phillips and Patrick Marnham. And we've got a trial offer. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.